Today's sermon is the final installment in our series on healing the heart of democracy. And I come to you this morning just consumed by this election. I don't know about you, but I have been glued to the news, glued to social media, craning my neck to see that car wreck, unable to pull myself away. Some of it, I'm sure, is the drama of it, the what in the world could happen next. But I also think I sense the importance and the stakes. This election, I believe, has thrown back the curtain to expose raw wounds and deep burning questions in our country and in our human experience. Hear again the words you just read from Thomas Merton. We are living in the greatest revolution in history, a huge spontaneous upheaval of the entire human race, a deep elemental boiling over of all the inner contradictions that have ever been in humanity, a revelation of the chaotic forces inside everybody. Not something we have chosen, or that we are free to avoid. We are certainly in a time of great change. Non-whites now make up a majority of kindergartners. By the next presidential election, the Census Bureau predicts non-whites will be a majority of all children. And by 2044, no one racial group will be a majority of the country. In 1960, our foreign-born population was 10 million, and today it is 40 million. On the phone, we are often asked to press 1 for English. We have a black president. We have stay-at-home dads. Same-sex couples have the right to marry. Transgender people are feeling a bit more safe to come out and transition. We could have a female president. The other day, I found myself in deep wonder about how a female president would change the presidency. What would we call her husband if he were not a former president? Not the first lady, first gentleman? Would the restrooms off of the Oval Office need to be changed in any way? Would we say, Madam President? For me, all of those changes, for me, inspire curiosity, excitement, celebration. But to some, these massive changes inspire fear and anxiety. Change indeed can be hard. And these are not just mere shifts, but revolutions. No wonder some people are hoping for a return to a previous time when America was supposedly great. No wonder some are asking for walls to be built on our borders, a total lockdown on Muslims entering our country, a mass deportation of all immigrants, or at least immigrants of color. We can and we should call this xenophobia, racism, even hatred. But what we should not do is pretend that we enlightened Unitarian Universalists are separate and superior to this. Again, yes, we can and should condemn hatred when we see it, but we should not pretend that we are completely invulnerable to this same fear of change. Each one of us, me, you, has much to unlearn in fearing the other, in holding on tight to the status quo. Last week, at a gathering of Presbyterian ministers, Melissa Harris Perry, a Unitarian Universalist, spoke from within the context of our current election, saying, "Liberal rhetoric suggests that your beloved community stops at the rim of the basket of deplorables." But she continued, we can never call other people monsters. Anything a human can do, you can do. They're not monsters, they're human. And if we distance ourselves from the reality of that, we cannot confront it. The us and them mentality in our culture is rampant. At last year's Democratic debate, Anderson Cooper quoted FDR, who said, "Judge me by the enemies I have made." And then he asked the candidates, "You've all made a few people upset over your political careers. Which enemy are you most proud of?" Without batting an eye, each of them listed off enemies they were proud of, to much applause and laughter. Bad things happen when we imagine each other as enemies. We Unitarian Universalists believe in the inherent worth and dignity of each person. We know humans can do things that are awful, even evil. We know that awful, even evil systems can take people far from their worth and their dignity. But we are called to invite people back, hard as it may be, to an understanding of that worth and that dignity. This requires respect, empathy, imagination. Wendell Berry said, "Respect always implies imagination, the ability to see one another across our inevitable differences as living souls. If what we see and experience does not become real in imagination, then it can never become real to us, and we are forever divided from it." I do not want to be forever divided from half of the country. I do not want to be forever divided from my extended family members whose political, social, and religious beliefs are very different from mine. I do not want to be divided even from people in this congregation who have different beliefs than I do. So the question is, as Melissa Harris Perry put it, how big is your beloved community? I've used the phrase beloved community many times in our services, and when I arrived at this church last year, I found it already to be part of our vision statement. Right there on the website, we say, "Our vision is to build the beloved community." And then we quote Reverend Dr. King's definition of the beloved community: a completely integrated society, a community of love and justice. The term beloved community was coined by the early 20th century American philosopher Josiah Royce. But most of us learned it from Reverend Dr. King, who said, "The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opponents into friends. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of men." But as my colleague Carl Gregg points out, notice what Dr. King, is not saying. He is not saying what we are often accustomed to hearing in our highly competitive society, that the end goal is a crushing victory over our opponents. For King, building the beloved community requires the even harder work of reconciliation. Like Jesus embodied, a love that dares to transgress cultural and tribal divisions. From that perspective, Gregg continues, I think G.K. Chesterton's view on Christianity applies equally to Dr. King's vision of the beloved community. It has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and not tried. Creating a true beloved community is difficult. Just as our faith, Unitarian Universalism, is difficult. We come together here with diverse beliefs. Some of you hear me pray each week and have to translate it into your own Buddhist meditation, for example. For others, I may not use enough theological language. Yet we believe we need not think alike, to love alike, to come together and build a beloved community. Likewise, democracy is difficult. We come together with our different ideas and experiences, and we push and we pull, we argue, we listen, we compromise, we stand firm, wrestling with different visions of the world and different strategies for how to make real those visions. It's always a mess because we humans are a mess. That's why I love that very messy book of Genesis in the Hebrew Bible shared by Jews and Christians. It is full. Do you remember it? Those of you that know it, it is full of stories of deceit, adultery, murder. To me, that book of Genesis is a timeless record of people struggling to make sense of what it is to be human in this world, what it is to be in right relationship with each other, who God is, what our relationship with God or peace or justice might require of us. There are no easy answers in that text, no fairy tales. Instead, many silences into which we can imagine ourselves, our own questions and doubts and messy human lives. In fact, literature scholars have shown how the stories in that book are told in such a way as to invite moral reflection. When we wrestle, truly wrestle with the text, we can wrestle with our own lives. But here's the key. We must read it in community. Because we need to hear the ways others hear the text. Others lift up questions and life experiences unavailable to us. We grow in empathy. We grow in our understandings of moral complexity. We grow in our discernment of our own spiritual questions and beliefs. And little by little, we find pathways forward. Democracy is very similar. We wade into the ruckus, and there, in what Merton calls that deep elemental boiling over of all the inner contradictions of humanity, we hopefully practice the habits of the heart that I've talked about in this sermon series. Let's review. There's number one, remembering we are all ultimately in this together. Number two, appreciating the value of otherness. Three, holding tensions in life-giving ways. Four, personal voice and agency. All of these are connected to the fifth and final habit of the heart, community. Even personal voice and agency, I could not talk about it in my last sermon without connecting it to community. Parker Palmer, the Quaker, who spoke of these five habits of the heart, said that each of them require inner work. The powers that open the heart, open the mind, invite the soul into being. And he stressed that this inner work must be done in community. Because, as he said, we're so gifted at self-delusion, of hearing only certain voices within ourselves. In many religious traditions, community is essential to spiritual and social change. The term beloved community is often the secular version of the Christian concept of the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of God, as feminist Christians call it. In Islam, Muhammad's vision was about revolutionizing society and building a mother community, ummah, based on the bonds of faith. In Buddhism, the Sangha, the community of practice, is essential to one's ability to practice the Dharma teachings. So even though this election pits us against each other, And we must take clear actions for the causes that we believe in. We must not forget that our faith also calls us to build a wider, beloved community where all are reconciled, where all the human community can thrive. I'd like to close this sermon and this series with the performance of the poem "Let America Be America Again" by Langston Hughes. It was written in the 1930s, but it is still very much real today. So in a moment, you'll see a woman, Abena Coomson, performing the poem in Union Square, New York City. Let it remind us to stay engaged, hard as it may be, with this democracy, with we the people.